Hello everybody and welcome to Mind Clickers. I'm a sport and exercise scientist from Melbourne, Australia, with a passion for esports performance, coaching, and overall mental well-being. I've been in esports for quite my life, previously competing in COD 4 Pro Mod and coaching StarCraft 2, whilst avidly loving CSGO and all FPSs. I created Mind Clickers to provide an insight into the psychological and performance demands of elite level gaming. This includes getting an insight from coaches, players, staff, org founders, and esports researchers about their respective domains. In the following episode, I chat with Conair Delaney McNulty, who is currently from Trent, England, and currently working with Enclave as an esports performance and cognition coach. He's also currently studying an esports MA and has some really good pivotal things to share. My chat with Conair was really awesome as he delved deep into cognitive testing and the importance of understanding cognitive tests from an external perspective and how these tests can start to implement change upon players' performance as well. We also talked sports science, and also Conair shares a very funny martial arts story. Speaking of martial arts, our partners over at Player 2 Secondhand Gaming are slicing up tons of deals, so make sure you check them out over at player2oz.com, where you can pick up tons of great deals on old games, modern games, retro games, and consoles and collectibles as well. And as listeners of Mind Clickers, use code MIND10 for 10% off. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Season 2, Episode 8 of Mind Clickers, where it's time to click both heads in 2021. I'm joined here today with Conair Delaney McNulty, who is a freelance performance esports coach with a focus on cognition and performance, currently working with Enclave from the UKLC. He also has a first-class degree in sports performance, with the majority of his third-year work focused within esports and currently studying an esports MA at the moment. How are you going today, mate?
Oh, not too bad. It's been a long one, but all the better. More time to do stuff, right?
Yeah, for sure. I'm glad we got the opportunity to catch up. I know we've been talking about it for a little while. Just hard with the time difference and everything to really solidify and book it in, but I'm glad you're on board, mate.
You too. It should be a great opportunity. I've been listening to some of your podcasts. They are really insightful. So more than happy to be the next one.
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to tick some boxes today and share some really good stuff with the guys listening as well. So I guess we'll start it off as we usually do with just a bit of an introduction about yourself, study history, and then a little bit of previous experience in esports.
Yeah, of course. So you introduced it really nicely. So yeah, I am working at the moment with Enclave and the UKLC as their main performance coach. I'm with their second split. So I did summer last year, doing the spring split with them this year as well. And let's see, hopefully beyond that. And then my background, like you said, sports performance bachelor's degree. Came out quite good with that. So a lot of that is obviously traditional sports work, but I created a focus in my third year of looking at esports, and it was a lot of transferring sports principles, periodization, nutrition into the esports world, which my tutors were intrigued about, and they let me focus in this area, which is lovely of them. And then since then, because I took a year out before coming on to the Masters, needed a rest, didn't want to burn myself out. I was head coaching for some amateur Overwatch teams. So I was playing that through uni, went into coaching afterwards. Nothing too extravagant, up to a 4K level, so low GM, high Masters. Really interesting experience coaching three teams at the same time.
Dang.
So yeah, a little bit busy with that, but it was really fun, really nice to see how people progressed and some good amateur tournament results, which was really lovely to see. And I actually got to hop in with one of the teams and play with them for one of that. And we went 10-0 undefeated that day. So can't say it was bad. And then from there, I've started to help out on side projects with a tournament house and production company called PKG or Project Gap from the UK, just kind of helping on their directory board and direct some of the ideas and make everything flow smoothly. Yep. But from that, yeah, currently working with Enclave as their performance coach, a lot of work in League, which I wasn't very experienced at. Well, I had no experience coming into it. But with the performance side of things, you need to understand the mechanics of the game. You don't need to know how to play it. Which has done me wonders.
So you mentioned you did a little bit, obviously, throughout your bachelor's with in traditional sports, and then you transitioned into esports. What made that you feel like you're going to go into that transition? Was that you previously were, you know, quite a gamer? You know, how did you come about that kind of, I want to go down the esports route now?
I have a traditional sports background myself, and unfortunately, due to personal reasons and injury, I essentially just had to take a hiatus from that. So I watched a lot of esports when I was younger, just late at night, couldn't sleep. I'll stick on Twitch, let's see what's going on. Oh, CSGO Major, StarCraft, League of Legends. This is interesting. Mm-hmm. And then being introduced to Overwatch at the same time by a roommate in second year meant after I couldn't physically train, there was another option for me, another avenue I could explore. And surface level exploration showed that there's very little in this area currently. Mm. And the links made from the transferable knowledge was like, this is new, this is challenging, let's continue this. Let's see where I can take it.
Yeah, for sure. That definitely sounds really awesome. I love the passion as well, obviously, kind of having that kind of background and then going into it, you know, kind of that sports degree and then an opportunity to present itself to do an esports MA. Definitely awesome. And I wish we had more of that stuff over here. Is something, you know, that kind of esports MA primarily just in the UK? Because I definitely know we don't have really something specific like that over here in Australia.
Yeah, I think the educational system in the UK, we're looking at esports a lot more. I know Staffordshire Uni, they started offering the esports MA last academic year. So I'm the second year ever on this course. So it's still testing it out a bit internally. You can tell at times. But there's an esports bachelor's in a few unis now in the UK, as well as college level. So your A levels, your 16 to 18 esports like BTECs and diplomas. So we're definitely trying to enhance the understanding from a younger age. So like surrounding esports, which is, it's great to see. And I think the British Esports Association has driven some of this. But yeah, the opportunities are not far and wide at the moment, and it is still a underdeveloped industry, sport, and ecosystem in general.
Yep. So within your master's and within your bachelor's, specifically kind of that esports kind of stuff, what kind of stuff do you go ahead and learn then? Like what kind of things do you draw upon? Is it more so, you know, you get an opportunity to go on a placement, for example, you get an opportunity to directly connect with the team through the uni. How does that kind of work with experience and really starting to adopt and kind of blend into that kind of esports scene?
On the esports masters, I can say there's been a little bit of a stunt in opportunities due to the pandemic situation. Yep. First hand working with a team or connections or in-person connections are obviously difficult at the moment, let's say, but there's a lot of great minds. So one of the lecturers has worked with Riot themselves as a production manager and worked on some of these big events, and we've had lecturers who have done like events and arena strategies. Yeah. And then one of my lecturers, actually Dr. Yingying Law, is an ex semi-pro Hearthstone player, and that,
wow,
yeah, she's been on stage Insomnias before competing. So there's a wealth of knowledge. And then we look at stuff like the policy and planning, the arena strategies, and this background, this foundational work which is needed within the industry. But then the bachelor's was a lot of his nutrition or his planning a training program, and me going, I can do this in esports, right? This would work. This is needed. And they're like, go on then. And a lot of just transferring other knowledge, other sports knowledge, and just picking from anywhere, mm-hmm, and trying to create a coherent statement which fits the course, but then it's also on this really new and interesting, almost groundbreaking topic.
Yeah, for sure. That's similar to myself when I did my Bachelor of Sport and Exercise Science. They tend to, I guess, incorporate a multitude of different areas, you know, motor control or a little bit of sports psychology, a little bit of biomechanics, a little bit of exercise prescription, and then, you know, even nutrition, trying to kind of tick all the boxes at a very basic level. And then obviously when you go into the masters, that's where you can really go down that specific route. But I'm glad, you know, going through and doing an esports masters, that sounds absolutely awesome. And obviously with the pandemic, it's a little bit unfortunate that you weren't actually able to get, you know, right in with the team. But obviously working with Enclave, that sounds absolutely fantastic. So take us through that. You know, what are some of the things you do with these guys? Is it more about, you know, cognitive testing? You know, what's your approach with these guys, and what's your ultimate goal with these guys?
There's definitely a personal approach on cognitive testing. It's something I found in the sports degree, and I was like, this could be useful here. I've run some tests on myself. I've taken that to the athletes as well. But then also supporting the coaching staff and the managers about how to plan out for a 6-week season, how to make sure we're not training every day, we're not essentially killing the athletes off in the first 3 weeks, and then obviously the performance is going to be worse than the last three. And then on a personal level with the athletes themselves, helping them understand that they are athletes. There is parts of their training which should be outside of game or should be away from the desk, which will help them when they come back to the desk. And it's that whole buzzword of holistic support is essentially, it sums up what I do quite well. So there is the testing, but then there's also just sitting down and talking with the players, figuring out what's going on there in their lives and how it might be affecting their performance. And if there's any strategies we can help with from a staff side to support them going through whatever it could be, whether it's uni stress, work stress, or personal problems.
Yeah, for sure. I love that. Just, you know, getting in and essentially not being too forceful or direct, but essentially kind of underlyingly building those foundations of rapport, essentially. You know, you go in, obviously when you first probably got there it was a bit difficult, and then, you know, you gradually build rapport with these athletes. They start to gradually become accepting of it, and obviously it's hard with some teams, you know, they haven't had this external support before. No. So having something like yourself come in and, you know, provide that little bit of support, work through, you know, different problems and kind of, you know, look at it from an external perspective, you know, breaking down a lot of these situations. For some of these players, you know, personally I've spoken to, have found it daunting, just because there's so much more. It's an extra layer of pressure that adds on to everything. So suddenly, you know, they're focusing on the games, but then they have to suddenly focus on the external things, their health, their mental performance, which is something I never really accounted for. So it's one of those things where it's kind of a little bit of a sticky situation. Have you ever found with some of these guys that they weren't really accepted to it? They weren't really open to kind of having a chat or, you know, talking with you?
Oh, definitely. There's normally always one or two individuals in each like team cycle for each split. I know in the first split we made a day of it. We had a full testing, introductions, education type of day, and it really put it. It really helped create a level of understanding between the team, both on what I want to do with them and what they can come to me for. And it's all about adding those extra levels of support, because even for a professional athlete, be it esports or traditional sports, they don't for 24 hours just do the sport or just do the game. They are humans, they are people, they've got lives. And if we can support them through their daily lives, it should give them a better foundational platform to perform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it comes back to that age-old question, which I always kind of ask myself. You know, some of these players have, you know, got to the stage where they're at because of their skills. And, you know, why would they change anything? Why would they introduce anything? And it's always, you know, taking a step back, you know, how we can suddenly, you know, smallly, holistically improve their quality of life. And, you know, whether it be providing a little bit of support, whether it be helping out on the side, whether it be having a chat with them after the game, seeing how did you feel, you know, how did you feel in those kind of different situations, and really building that rapport with them. I think it's definitely crucial. And I think it's definitely in a positive step direction for esports.
Definitely. Yeah. And there's more of a focus on it now, which is amazing. Like the UKLC and Enclave, it's not a top tier competition. It's not a top tier team, but they're still reaching out for the strategies to support their players. And after that first split in summer, a couple of players I get on quite well with, talk to them after the split a bit, and they're like, we don't care about the results. Yeah, we didn't do so hot, blah, blah, blah. But you guys ran stuff quite well. There was always support, there's always something in place, and that's amazing to hear. And the guys at Enclave, the management, have done a great job to support that beyond what I could do alone.
Yeah, definitely. And another question, with the coaches, with the org owners at Enclave, was it something that you approached them saying, hey, I can offer a little bit of support? Or was it something that those guys came to you and said, hey, you know, we're looking to maybe, you know, have our players get a little bit of assistance on the side? work on there, you know, maybe do some tests, run, help them through their kind of steps, help them, you know, deal with stage performance, help them on the side. How was that kind of interaction?
It was purely coincidental. A lot of things, unfortunately, these days are who you know, not what you do.
Right, yeah.
But working with the Overwatch teams, and it was a amateur org called Skylabs, they wanted to expand to League of Legends, and they did. And one of the League of Legends players happened to be one of the management team at Enclave.
Right.
So there's casual chats between us. I was brought in for Skylab's League of Legends team when things were getting a bit shaky or there was interpersonal issues. So we just got talking, and then he was like, we want to do more to support the players, and I've heard about your degree. Let's talk. Let's see what can be done here. So unfortunately, I can't give any advice to except for putting yourself in the right place, and hopefully you'll meet the right people.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I guess, you know, there's a lot of opportunities that arise, whether it be doing something different, whether it be having a different mindset to something, whether it be waking up in the morning and thinking, I'm going to try this out. I do agree with you. Sometimes it is who you know over what you know, and unfortunately that's the way it is, as bad as it is sometimes. But it is one of those situations that definitely can be overcome with persistence, you know, just kind of chipping away, and gradually we can essentially make that happen, I'm sure of it. So tell us, what are the things you go through with these guys? So obviously, from a performance and testing kind of perspective, is it more so, you know, running some cognitive tests pre-season and then kind of doing the post-season as well and showing the coach, hey, you know, we tested reaction speed, we tested reaction speed at the end, they've improved drastically, even though they lost or even though they didn't perform well in the tournament, you know, they're gradually chipping away at their own, you know, psychological skills and, you know, as such.
Almost, yeah. It's that sort of approach. So the first thing I always like to make sure is they know what they're doing and why they're doing it. Mm-hmm. So it started with an introductory session where I broke down some of the concepts of my past work and the things I've picked up on myself, which led into then a batch of cognitive tests pre-season. And these are, again, just to assess key performance indicators or determinants from the game.
Right.
So I can break down these tests, but there's a few other things we did that day. So we went through the testing battery. It's quite a fun experience. And one thing I like to make sure is I will never ask an athlete to do something I either haven't done myself or I thoroughly know how it can support them. So this testing battery I did on myself in uni. I ran repeated trials on myself. So I did the entire battery 3 times in 1 day, which I would not advise to anyone. That was a very long 5 hours. That was...
Dang.
Yeah, not. You don't need to do the test 3 times in 1 day. Once is enough. Yeah. So I had the experience. I could coach them through it effectively, let them know what's going to happen, how it will run.
Mm-hmm.
Then we did a bit of a like close-off section going, here's some basic nutritional principles I've looked into before. Here's some other things I can support with. I can create training plans, so physical training plans around your needs and your requirements, and also plan these out in a way which won't negatively affect the performance. So let's not have a heavy arm and shoulder day the day before competition, because that's going to be stiff trying to aim after that. And then for the cognitive tests themselves, I stuck to validated scientific tests. So there's no AIM Labs, no COVAX involved. Especially for a MOBA, it's a little bit different to an FPS. But I ran 5 cognitive tests, so a visual search task by Motta et al. 2008. So it's how well you can like find something on a screen. Very important in League.
Right.
To ascertain, did you see someone on your ward across the map? Mm-hmm. Did someone come out of jungle? If so, who was it? Which way were they going? Did you see a flash in the corner of your screen mid-fight? Very useful skill. Next was a psychomotor vigilance test by Thomman et al. 2014. That's just a fancy term for reaction time. So they were just pressing spacebar at a stimuli for about 10 minutes. So it's just random stimuli, press spacebar. Nice simple test, directly applicable to a lot of fast motor function activities.
Mm-hmm.
And now, next one's a bit speculative, but it was fun to run. The Baddeley Grammatical Reasoning Test, which is a 1968 test by Baddeley. Essentially, it's 64 statements. So an example is A comes before B, and then it's A and B. And you have to say true or false.
And Oh, God.
It's timed. It's 3 minutes timed for 64 questions.
Jeez.
So it's quite intensive, but it's short, which is the lovely thing. You know it's over with very soon. And it's meant to assess higher order executive functioning, which is like your subconscious thought process. Mm-hmm. So you could infer, and this is quite a speculative inference, someone better at this might be better at thinking macro and late game and thinking about the game from a new perspective.
Right.
And then next was a four-choice reaction time task. Very simple. One of four options would light up on a screen. Just mm-hmm. click the corresponding key. It's just a reaction time test with a little bit more depth to it. And translating that into League itself, it's what ability do you use in a certain situation? Do you try and flash? Do you try and CC someone? Do you try and get out? Do you try and engage? And how quickly you can respond? Then last was the Santa Barbara Solids by Cohen and Haggerty, 2012. And this is all about like perception. So how you perceive a task or a situation. So you are given a shape and then a cross section of that shape and which cross section matched up with that shape. So there's two things I looked at here, just how many times they got it correct. So whether they can think about things in a new light and then also how long it took them. So we're looking at, I think, first trials for some individuals, the average was like 20 seconds.
Dang.
And it, within 3 weeks of training interventions, it dropped to about 11 seconds with a similar or better accuracy.
Wow.
Which you can't fault an athlete for that. That's amazing. Couldn't expect results of that difference in such a short time, which is really nice.
Dang. And so do you make all the athletes of the team go through this process as well?
Yeah, everyone on the team went through this, and it was an interesting day for staff as well, because I invited the staff to go along and do it as well. So we had some of the managers doing it.
Wow.
But we were set up through a Discord stream. But the software which I used completely locks you out of your PC. Like, you can't alt F4, you can't alt tab it.
All right.
you are in that test until it's done. But we had them on a Discord call, deafened and muted, with cameras on.
Gotcha.
So us as staff, we could sit and watch their response and see when people were getting frustrated or they're like, someone missed one of the reaction times. You're like, oh
that's brilliant. See it. I like that.
Which is really interesting from my perspective, knowing the pain I went through doing this 3 times in a day.
Yep.
But no, it was a group activity, which was really nice and monitored as well, which is one of the main points of any testing. So there's a few minutes before when like the final break before testing, would you all like to clean your desks and send me a photo? So when we test again, I can make sure the desk is the same, the mouse is the same, the keyboard's in the same position. Mm. And there's also just less visual stimuli getting in the way. There's nothing in front of their PC, nothing in front of their screen.
Gotcha.
And just trying to control that variable as well.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned, so these tests you previously ran by yourself, you know, you did the battery yourself and you understood they were effective and they worked. But in regards to, you know, other performance coaches coming in, are we going to see in esports a gradual development of a standardization of these tests? You know, when, for example, obviously in League, you talked about the four choice reaction time, whether we're going to flash, whether we're going to hit the right button for CC. That's really pivotal. You know, that test makes sense. But what happens if we have some coaches coming in, they're not running the right sort of tests, and they're just kind of impacting that performance? You know, is there going to be a point where we can refer to maybe a regulation for tests, where we can refer to a standardization, where we can, you know, look up, okay, these are the good tests for, you know, FPS, these are the good tests for a MOBA, a couple of these tests should be done for, like, you know, Rocket League or, you know, StarCraft. Are we going to start to see that kind of happen over time, do you think?
It'd be great if it could. And something I picked these particular tests because they are all although not esports valid, they are not designed towards esports, they are scientifically valid. So it doesn't matter what esport you're in or what you're doing with these tests, they are proven to measure what they're supposed to measure. And all of the surrounding science behind it has been worked out that these are correct in some form. But beyond that, it's the transference of how you can relate this task to in-game. And these will not be the best tests. Like, categorically, they won't be the best tests. There's a lot of nuance or small factors in esports, which these just don't cover.
Yep.
But at the moment, we don't have any way to assess or even create the perfect testing battery.
Yeah.
And it's going to be ages really... until we can.
Yeah. I think it'd be really awesome if we see someone like Riot, you know, for example, specifically for League of Legends, start to develop a testing battery, you know, that can start to, you know, assess specifics. So they're actually in there, they're actually using the champion, they're actually doing this kind of externally, this cognitive test. Because, you know, as you said, one of the biggest things, sometimes specificity is one of the biggest problems. And if we can have it as specific as possible, then the athletes will start to understand, okay, I'm doing this, I'm starting to actually see these kind of little changes, starting to see the performance gains.
If we can somehow work to make these ecologically valid, so in-game, in-client, the wealth of data and how applicable that data is going to be a lot better. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even your Kovacs and your AIM Labs, they are external tests. They do very well at recreating the first-person shooter space.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always a mimic. It's never true. It's never true to the game, whether it's CSGO, Valorant, Overwatch.
Right.
There's little things you're missing there.
Yeah, whether you're missing, you know, specific recoil patterns might not be the same if you're spraying, your target spraying, movement might be the same. You know, there's kind of little nuances that, you know, once we start to hopefully start to open the barriers in terms of esports performance testing, we can start to gradually see maybe some more adoption, which would be awesome.
Really would.
In regards to results, that's something I'm really curious about. So when you get these results, you know, after they finish maybe the preseason, they do these tests, is it straight away that you know, you go and, you know, have a chat with the athletes and say, hey, you scored this on this, now we're going to start, you know, maybe throughout the season start to work on this a little bit? Do you take these results to the coaches, have a chat with them, and, you know, really start to digress these results? You know, what's your kind of game plan with those?
Definitely, at some point you need to approach the athlete with the tests. They're normally very interested in seeing what they scored as well, which is great. It means they have some passion behind what they do.
It
does take a good 36, 48 hours to process, make them look pretty, get all of the data you don't need out of there, because the software gave a lot of data, and that's not easy to digest. And then in terms of bringing it to coaches or management, very casually bring it with them. The players were already on the team. It's not going to change anything. But it's more being able to show the progression through my work. So after a retest session, go, yeah, they've improved here, they've improved at this point, both for buy-in from the athletes. So I can sit down with the athletes after a retest and go, yeah, you're improving here, you're improving here. This is really nice to see. Let's keep it up. And then, especially because of how new the performance role is within a lot of esports, being able to get the buy-in from the managers and go, yeah, this is what I'm doing with the guys. Look at this. They're getting better. Imagine we do this for 6 months. You might have Faker on your team by then. I won't be able to make a Faker, but it's the one elite player I know. I'm going to drop that reference.
And how do you account for those external variables? You know, so for example, these players know ahead of plan that they're going to be doing a testing. You know, how do you know that they got the appropriate amount of sleep at night? They had a really nice breakfast, for example. They didn't just take, you know, down a monster quickly before doing one of the tests, you know, dare I say caffeine. you know. You know, how do you account for these variables? Or is it more so, you know, hey guys, we're going to do a normal scrim session, but suddenly you pop up, here I am, what's going on? Let's run these tests, let's get it done.
It's always advertised on the schedule as a performance session. So the first one, they were quite blind to what was going to happen. The second one, so the retest, they've put it together by then. They know what that means. But for both of those days, ensuring the desk is clean and tidy with photo evidence means I can help control the environment. But they all went through, and I made sure there was essentially a pre-screening questionnaire. So before they even took the tests, a little 5 minutes, which looked at how much sleep they got, what they've eaten, if they have had any caffeine.
Yep.
And essentially, if they hadn't had enough sleep, it would have been an immediate, we don't do that today.
Mm.
We'll come back tomorrow and we'll do it tomorrow. And then I can compare through these pre-screening questionnaires whether there was any major differences which might impact test one compared to test two.
Yep.
But yeah, controlling the variables is massively important with any testing, and especially finite testing where you're trying to actively compare pre and post.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if they had less than 7 hours sleep, I would have told them to leave. Like, yeah, cool.
Yep.
No skin off their back, no pressure because of it either, because life happens. It could have been for really personal reasons. They couldn't get the sleep. So no added stress or no added pressure because of any of those factors. And then if they like hadn't had breakfast, I'd be like, go eat breakfast tomorrow, and then we'll do it, don't worry.
I guess it is one of those kind of case factors in regards to not really reliability or validity, because obviously the tests are reliable and they're valid, but kind of controlling those external factors that aren't directly in your control, it's definitely hard to do. And big vouch for you, man. I really approve of what you're doing.
Yes, yeah, it was really interesting because this is actively one of the pieces I did in my undergrad, hence doing the tests on myself. So it wasn't even my dissertation, but I wanted to make sure when I did them on myself, the results were accurate results.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant, making sure each day was the same, my food intake was pretty much the same, and just following scientific principles throughout.
Yeah, for sure. When I did a little bit of esports performance coaching with StarCraft a little while ago, definitely that kind of four-choice reaction time was crucial. Just because in StarCraft, you want to be making sure you're hitting the key bindings because the intensity is so there. Every second is crucial in terms of micro and macro and how fast we can do something. Usually in regards to APM, actions per minute, in a game of StarCraft, it can easily get upwards of 300, 350, especially at the Grandmaster Master level. And if you're doing that many actions per minute, you know, one of the things is there going to be a speed accuracy trade-off? And obviously at that kind of level, you want to be accurate because you want to be hitting the right bindings. You want to be making sure you're moving your units properly. You want to be making sure you're ticking those boxes in regards to performing well.
Oh yeah, definitely. I just remember watching StarCraft years ago, and when a Zerg player spiked to 600 APM, you're like, whoa, okay.
What are they doing? Lot.
Yeah.
They've taken their hand off their mouse at that point. Now, in regards to esports performance and esports performance characteristics, how would you define a good esports performance player? You know, what kind of tasks or traits would we kind of put in, you know, kind of stack in the mixing bowl to make sure that an esports performance player is, you know, kind of ticking the boxes for what they need to do?
This, I don't know. Actually, I don't know. We don't have the longitudinal data to be able to pick out, like you can in tennis or like rugby. So tennis, you've got your agility, your power, your speed, and we know that's needed. You can start to kind of point towards some characteristics. They have to, their mechanics, and you can break that down into obviously your accuracy, your speed, but there's no list. No one's working off a list here. We are all kind of guessing.
Yeah.
But if I had to name a few things, obviously visual search and hand-eye coordination. And I think that's across the board in the majority of esports.
Yep.
Reaction times, again, across the board, and it's the same in a lot of sports.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mental factors as well. Anyone who can keep calm under pressure or at least has an awareness of their emotions should be able to self-regulate a little bit more in game. So the players who may get a little bit tilted in solo queue is probably acceptable, but those who completely lose it and start making poor decisions through their emotions, they may not be able to perform under pressure as well, or they'll need extra support to be able to perform under pressure. I think the ability to learn, whether it's about yourself or about the game, is really important within esports. Because if you can learn your own traits, you can work on them. And that openness to develop and grow, especially at a tier two level, is probably very, 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 can't find the word, just going to keep saying very. It's probably very important. Mm-hmm. Because any competitive sport, you're looking to grow and develop, and hopefully the results come along with that.
Yeah, for sure. Fantastic. Completely agree, mate. There's so many underlying factors. And as you mentioned, kind of that emotional regulation. From an external perspective, you know, we can start to improvise, you know, we can start to introduce different techniques like visualization, meditation, breathing, whether it be before a game, whether it be in the lobby, whether it be after they had a death and they're kind of running back into lane. We can start to gradually introduce these kind of underlying techniques that can ultimately contribute to a better performance. But ultimately, we can't, you know, indefinitely say that, you know, it is going to happen, because ultimately at the end of the day, it's up to them. And they're the ones who ultimately do understand that. They understand the change, and they understand that doing this can lead to change. So I think it's definitely kind of it's a hard area, especially if we don't have as much research in compared to traditional sports, where they're really, you know, banging out research left, right, and center. That's not to say that esports doesn't have as much research. Obviously, there's a lot of research starting to come out recently, as esports has gone through such an exponential growth time, which is going to be really exciting to see what kind of research we see. But at the end of the day, yeah, I definitely agree with you on those few things.
We're just shooting in the dark and hoping we see some positive performance or results from it. But personally, if you can follow known scientific procedure, or at least safe procedure, mm-hmm. there shouldn't be any downfall. The risks are calculated and they should be supportive. Unfortunately, the worst case scenario, you've lost some time. But if it's only time you've lost, you've at least learned something from that yourself. And hopefully the athletes have as well.
Yeah, for sure. And one thing I'm really curious about from a sports science perspective, which I'm really keen to hear your thoughts on, I've been kind of dwindling about the idea in a couple of previous episodes in regards to sports performance, you know, sports science tracking for esports, and how we can accurately start to, you know, record some measurements, whether that be looking at heart rate during a game, heart rate spikes, you know, pressure situations, whether that be looking at breathing. You know, for example, if we're in a clutch situation in FPS, do we hold our breath? You know, I definitely, when I used to play, I used to hold my breath. You know, how much of a detrimental impact is that having? Is that having an impact going into the next round? Is that having an impact on not being able to cool down and relax? And even eye tracking, for example, you know, there's a lot of eye tracking tech that's starting to come out, you know, that can really start to help, obviously, with that kind of visual search acquisition you were talking about earlier. It also starts to kind of link in nicely. So what are your thoughts on that kind of scene and how we can progress and start to kind of introduce it into esports?
Data is always important. Like, we have loads of data in clients. Normally, you can go like damage stats, you can track gold per minute, so much you can track. But we know quite little about the individual sat behind the screen, the one actually doing this. Mm. So there needs to be more development so we can understand it. An understanding, obviously, heart rate response in pressure situations. We could hypothesize that the more stressed mm-hmm. an athlete is due to a situation, the higher the heart rate will be. But regulating the performance impact on that, it could be important just to develop if we need to work on the heart strength of an individual so they can perform better. But it's going to be, I think, years of trial and error to figure out what is actually viable and important in esports performance. Because we don't have particularly similar tasks in everyday life with heaps of research about them. Mm-hmm. So we're at a point where we can track all of this data, and we have to start tracking all of this data just to see which data is even worth tracking in the first place. So that
definitely, and it's also a question of who's going to get tracked. You know, if you're going to be tracking the top tier, you know, top tier ones, Cloud9, Fnatic, G2, are they going to be on board with this? Are we going to have to look to do kind of that semi-pro leagues? And obviously, if you're tracking those big kind of the big titans of the sport, is that going to be detrimental to their performance? They're going to start to perform differently. Obviously, you want to, for obvious reasons, you want to track in a tournament setting just to get that right validity. But is that going to have an impact on their performance? And, you know, how can we account for that?
Implementing this in a way which doesn't affect performance, I think it's going to be one of the trickiest factors. No matter how you're tracking heart rate, there's going to be an extra monitor the athlete has to wear. Are they comfortable with it? Is it a distraction? Is it too tight? Do they notice it 30 minutes into a game all of a sudden and it's all they can focus on? So getting the participants for this in a way which is both ecologically valid and worthwhile for the teams themselves, it's going to be difficult. Taking it out of a competitive situation, doing it in a quote-unquote research lab, will still provide some data, and I think some knowledge, so we can infer what could be happening in the higher stress situations. But it's going to be a long and arduous journey, that we are almost 60 years behind sport in creation. So therefore, are we 60 years behind sport in research? We have a lot of time to catch up, and the prize pools are just, they're just getting bigger. So it's, we've not missed the days where esports athletes are easily accessible half the time on their hands and there's nothing to lose. Because obviously if you drop out of the TI or you lose a TI match, you're losing millions of dollars.
Right.
There's a big cost or potential big cost if this research or any further research does affect performance on stage. So
definitely,
it needs to be done in the safe environment for the organizations, because that's what they'll care about.
Yeah. And as you said, the risk, you know, some esports tournaments, the prize pools are bigger than traditional sports. Yet look how much traditional sports has its backing. It has regulations, it has committees, it has all those underlying bodies to help contribute to the research, to help contribute to make sure that the performance for players is in top notch, to make sure that the players are being supported. Yet we look at esports and they have bigger prize pools. And bigger prize pools, you know, obviously that means, you know, more temptation. More temptation could mean that players are kind of strive for it a lot more. More strivation could mean that they're putting themselves at risk. And it comes down to, again, one of those big factors of risk. And, you know, obviously with esports, rotations are very short sometimes. You know, someone could be rostered on for 2-3 months at a time. They could suddenly do their wrist and that's it. And I guess it is one of those things where we need to try and see how we can accurately and sufficiently support the players to ensure longevity for performance as well, because it's one of those factors where there's a lot of money at stake. And also, you know, again, in marketing, there's so much money gone towards marketing, but how much is going towards research? It's definitely an interesting question. And yeah, sadly, that one that I can't really tick all the boxes to.
No, it's, I'm sure a fraction, if not, well, if nothing, is going towards research. Although there's a greater openness towards it now. You've got a few teams, Astralis with Lars Robbel, a great sports performance coach who's moved into the esports space. Excel have Fabian Broch, I think it's pronounced, Fabian Broch, a German performance coach who's very on the ball about everything, effectively. There's a lot of information he wants to try and figure out, and he's actively trying to do what he can for the space. So we're getting there. We are definitely getting there slowly. But whether it's too slow, because esports is expanding very quickly and has over the last 10 years, is, who knew we'd be sitting at home with 3 million other people watching our finals?
Legit, yeah. And then who also thought that the people being watched are, you know, 15-year-olds, you know?
Oh,
It all comes down to it, that kind of age of entry as well. It's getting lower and lower. You're seeing 10-year-old professionals, you're seeing 11-year-old pros competing in CSGO. And then how's everything in regards to their mental health, you know, their development, education-wise? It's a big umbrella term, and it feels like we're only just adding droplets to the umbrella at this moment.
I think on that regard of young athletes, we are not in a black hole as much as we think we are. There's plenty of athletes in traditional sport going through 6-hour training days for gymnastics. For any sport which has, I think, a few of the female gymnasts in the last Olympics were 14 or 16. There's very little difference here. And we cannot be ignorant to the research or knowledge we can transfer. And we need to rely on that a lot more. But it can only be transferred. It needs to be added to and adapted to the new environment, to the esports environment.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely going to be interesting to see where we go and how we get there and how long it will be before we get there as well. Very interesting stuff. So in regards to your esports MA, you know, once you complete that master's, are you going to be looking to do similar kind of work, kind of that performance coaching? Where's your goal and direction after that?
At the moment, it's definitely still within what I like to call the esports athletic space. So looking at the factors a bit more sports-like within esports, whether it's the management, performance, or personal coaching side. Definitely a space which is expanding, and I'd like to try and be a part of it because there's a lot which needs to be done, and I hope I can add in my 2 cents worth type of thing and have some ideas which can help support those much better at me at games get even better at me at the games. You know, if you can't play your coach in some way or another.
Yeah, for sure. Do you think that you'll ever go back and do, you know, for example, some sports science or some performance coaching in traditional sports?
I think the skills are completely transferable. If you can break down any activity to its key performance indicators and support an athlete in enhancing those, there's no reason why an esports performance coach has to be limited to esports and a sports performance coach has to be limited to sports. I think they are one and the same, just different KPIs. So there'll be different things prescribed or different interventions. So on the fact of me working with traditional sports, it would be great. And let's see what happens in the next 3 years, 5 years of my life.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess, you know, when we do have that kind of interchange and swap between traditional sports and esports, I guess once we have esports performance coaches transitioning to something like traditional sports, we'll have a lot more of that cognitive understanding. So that can be really applicable and adaptable. Whereas those traditional coaches can come to esports and they'll have a lot more of that kind of physical fundamentals to help the players externally as well. So I can definitely see how it can be interchanged. And I think that's pivotal because I think having as much accessibility and openness to kind of have different diversities is crucial and key.
Yeah, with a slightly different focus, the more focuses you bring in, the more well-rounded picture or well-rounded development you can bring to an individual, to an athlete, or to a team. So
yeah, for sure.
I believe traditional sports, there's caveats to learn from esports and vice versa and from other industries as well, from your business management, your team management, because there's teams in both traditional sports and esports. There's a wealth of knowledge which needs to be shared.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that kind of leads really nicely into kind of traditional sports in regards to martial arts, for example. So I think I had a brief chat with you a while ago in regards to your previous martial arts experience. And obviously something like Taekwondo, karate, all those kind of physical sports, they have that really kind of cognitive mental toughness, well-being aspect as well. So I think that's where we can also have that kind of diversification in regards to having that physical performance, but then also being able to have that kind of cognitive backdrop and that mental fortitude and all those kind of, you know, gritty big terms that we throw around can be applicable.
Yeah, there's a lot to learn from traditional sports. And yeah, martial arts is my background. I started in karate when I was 5, trained for like 14 years total or something, went into taekwondo as well when I was 15 and competed. So I know the competitive stress and the mental toughness, and something which was big for me and I looked at with the guys from Enclave is pre-performance routines.
Right.
How to get you into that mindset. And what works for you. Yep. And I know from my background, it was always sticking on a nice big chunky pair of headphones and listening to some very angry metal. a little bit more applicable when you could be against or on the other side of a ring with someone trying to kick you in the face.
Build that rage, yeah.
In a lot of the esports, it's a fight. It's a 5v5 fight. Mm-hmm. You are granted on screen, but looking to win fights, win team fights, and win an objective off the back of that. So that mental toughness, knowing how to, very cliche term here, roll with the punches. If you lose an objective or lose a fight and reset yourself in the moment, have those three, four, five breaths of going, okay, what's next? Doesn't matter what just happened. What's next? What's the next objective? Mm-hmm. How do we play the next team fight? And that calmness and that reflection as well. So training in martial arts, end of each session was a minute sit down, eyes closed reflection. Mm. It's completely personal. And just having that slight moment to actually think of the last hour, the last 2 hours, what have you learned? What have you progressed? What have you developed? What's next? Is a really, it's a very probably surface level meditation, but it's still needed to reset the body and the mind on what you've just done and what's coming up next and what you need to progress on. And I'll give a small funny story here. I'm not gonna doss the name of who it is, but years ago in my competitive phase, I was in a finals for North of England Championships against someone who actually owned an esports org in the UK, and he still does, in a competitive team, and he broke my nose on the mats.
Jeez.
Funny story. Although I won the fight, but he broke my nose. And if he does listen to this, he knows who he is. So might have to get you back one day for this.
How did he break your nose?
Oh, hook kick to the face.
Ah.
Pop a head flicks back. I'm like, oh, okay. Oh, what's happening? Cool. Go for the next point. And then I'm like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm bleeding. Yeah, this is not okay. Yeah. Give me a sec. I'll be back in half a minute. And just apparently need the medics to come look at me for a second. I'm good.
Dang. Yes, because I did Taekwondo as well. But I, similar to you, kind of started doing some sparring around 14, 15. But it wasn't the best because I was partnered with like 22-year-olds, 23-year-olds. The guy's literally physically twice the size of me, twice the like leg reach. And that just really wasn't a pleasurable experience. So I actually stopped quite shortly after that just because that was kind of traumatic in that sense that the, you know, going up against that wasn't the best. That's a very funny story. Hopefully he does listen and you get a bit of a laugh out of it.
Yeah, we ended up accidentally bumping into each other on LinkedIn because we both had esports in our title. And I'm like, I know you, mate. Your face rings a bell. And yeah, he's a cool guy, though. He's a cool guy. He's done well with his team and what he's doing in the UK, and especially with his media content is second to none in the UK scene. Not going to lie, they do a lot.
Dang, fantastic. So external to, you know, maybe martial arts, for example, could you see yourself working in any other traditional sports?
Oh, possibly. I think for me personally, I'd rather work with an individual. I like that.
Right.
Support and development on quite a personal level. And having someone who can turn to me with any range of questions and I can go, either I know the answer or give me a day or two and I'll get back to you.
Yep.
But
yeah,
it's always had some passion for either the performance sports, so I did also the fancy looking martial arts, the extreme flippy stuff, or or the fight sports too, because they are where I've had a lot of fun in the past. Nothing beats the thrill of being kicked in the face, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I can definitely kind of relate to that. Being able to kind of interact with someone in a one-on-one setting, it's a lot different in regards to a group setting when you're aggressing a group. It's a different style of approach, different communication approach. It's a different kind of thought process as well, how you're going to execute whatever you're trying to do, whether that be building rapport, whether it be, as you said previously, you know, trying to help someone get in the zone. Because if you try and do that in a group setting, it might not work. You know, you might be trying to say, okay, everyone, we're going to close our eyes now for 2 or 3 minutes. We're going to have some habitual reflection. We're going to have some situational reflection. How did the last session go? But some of those guys might not like it. Some of those guys might be like, I can't do it. I can't focus. But some of the other guys might just flow right down the river and be like, yeah, that was awesome. So it's a very individualistic approach. Definitely where I see myself working as well. Being able to really, you know, promote change in a one-on-one situation is definitely impactful.
Yeah, everything needs to be tailored to the individual, and everyone works in so many different ways. It's
mm-hmm.
always interesting to see what works for one individual and what might not for another. Although there is some aspects which it's nice to look at as a team. So we've looked at with Enclave basic personalities and personality types on a team level, just so they can get an understanding of each other. Just so they can both understand themselves and they can reflect on what we just randomized Briggs as a group, essentially. And then they can also look over to their teammate and go, oh yeah, that makes sense. That explains a lot of things. And just, it was used as a team bonding tool and it worked really well.
Yeah. And I think personality tests and those kind of different tests can help to develop team culture as well. In regards to, you know, celebration, someone might be, you know, really over the top when they're celebrating, fist bumps all around, or someone's like, yep, back in the zone now.
Yeah.
Team dynamic is a very interesting one. Have you noticed anything with Enclave that, you know, they have that kind of characteristic style of where everyone's over the top or everyone's kind of low, or, you know, there's a couple of different individuals that are different?
We've always had a couple individuals. So it's like one person on the team who's a bit more, I don't want to use the term flamboyant because it is not flamboyant, but they definitely look to put on a show. They want to entertain. And it's quite interesting to see that in their play style as well. And when things go well, it's definitely a show. And there was one match recently, and I'm being very careful not to spill any names. I don't want to drop any names here, but there could have been a very massive jungle diff, and it was lovely to watch, and you can tell that that's that person's character. So with team dynamics as well, it's always been strange with Enclave, and no fault of their own, but through the length of the split, the length of the trials season, it's very hard to get through the 4 stages of group dynamics before the season's actually started. Right. So there can be issues in the first week or two, which are completely natural for a new team, but that's obviously going to affect their performance. So you kind of put on the emergency situation. Okay, how do we fix this in 3 days? Which at times a little bit challenging.
Yep.
But it's all about an Enclave at the moment promoting a healthy team environment, and they're doing a really good job at that. I fit in recently. Especially this week, we've had some really nice team activities type of thing. Now, everyone is going on really well, but we are like mid to late in the split, so hopefully they would be by this time.
Yeah, right. And with team dynamics as well, sometimes there's a kind of leadership component as well, where there's maybe one individual who can kind of maximize player buy-in. If someone's not really, you know, feeling like it, they can kind of help them kind of get on board as well. Have you seen something like that as well?
Recently, I can't say I have, but that's just because personality types, and not everyone's a natural born leader. It's very hard to put someone in that sort of position or situation if it doesn't come naturally to them. And although leadership is something you can train, you can get better at, and you can learn about, it's very hard in a short season. So
yeah, for sure.
A lot of that just comes down to the players as individuals. But if you have a very friendly team, a very democratic team, leadership is more of a flow and a dynamic than it is one individual. So it's all about catering to the team and then essentially figuring out which strategy will work for them, not making someone uncomfortable by putting them in a position they just can't do.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. So I think we've actually touched on quite a few characteristic differences throughout this episode. You know, we've touched on kind of that whole kind of cognitive kind of battery in regards to performance testing, why we do that and the importance of it, how we can look at it in regards to maybe preseason, through season, postseason, the importance of, you know, having kind of that reliability and validity in regards to external environments, which is something I definitely think a lot of people can take away in regards to before doing a test, making sure. I definitely like that, taking a photo of your kind of desk. I think that's a really good one. Definitely something I didn't think of, but definitely think I think I'll start to adopt that now, just so I have a better understanding of their environment. Because, you know, one of those biggest things is these guys are playing in their rooms. You know, they're kind of, you know, that's their comfort zone. And then suddenly, you know, you can take them onto a stage and their environment is completely different. Everything's out of whack and it may be something they're not really comfortable with. So it'll be really interesting to see whether we can start to gradually change environments and start to build up that kind of understanding that we're in a different environment now, the crowd's there, the lights are there, there's a lot more things, but at the end of the day, we still have to perform the same as if we're in our own room, which is going to be interesting as well to see. And then a little bit about martial arts, which I love as well, because I definitely think we can both relate to it, which is awesome.
Yeah, it's interesting. I found a lot of people who've ended up in esports who have a martial arts background. I think there's like five I know now. And it's just one of those strange coincidences, I think. Or there's some underlying factor here. And it'd be great.
I think maybe you ticked the box before when you said it's how it's like an individual sport, because it's essentially you versus them. We're in the same as esports. It's a similar sort of thing. Definitely for myself, when I was doing Taekwondo, I was playing StarCraft at the same time. So it was kind of essentially me versus the enemy in Taekwondo, me versus the enemy in StarCraft. And it was a one-man army, essentially.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that could have an interesting component.
Yeah, it's just a technological interfaced fight sport. That's a very strange way to describe esports, but I might vibe with that for a bit now.
Yeah, for sure. So for everyone that's listening in and want to take away some even more tips and tricks, where can we find you on your socials if you're active on any of them?
Yeah, I have them, not particularly active, but I've got LinkedIn under my name. Yep, I use that one. Then I also have Twitter under at Coach Concentric. So Concentric was my initial Battle.net name when I started up on Overwatch. And I'll drop in, I might be needing semi-pro and pro players for my master's thesis. So if anyone's listening who is within that group, feel free to drop me a message once I've got my ethics approved. Hopefully I can start that, but I'll need a few esports players. Beyond that, I do have a Discord, but you'll also find me in the G-Science Discord a lot. So G-Science on Twitter should have a link there as well.
Yep, fantastic. I definitely think of a few players off the bat who might be listening, who might be interested in that. So I definitely think we'll keep in contact in regards to that. And maybe they can help to contribute to some awesome future esports research.
Oh, that would be amazing if anyone is. So thank you for the opportunity to get that message out there too. Finding participants is always tricky.
Anyway, it's been absolutely a pleasure having you on, mate. Definitely really interesting to kind of dig deep and get that kind of understanding of why we do some tests and how we do the testing as well, and the importance of these tests that they have in regards to esports player performance as well. So I really appreciate you jumping on and taking the time. Obviously a little bit of a time difference, but I'm really glad we managed to work it out in the end.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, really. And good morning to you. It's morning here as well now.
Yep, good night to you, mate. And thank you very much for tuning in once again to an episode of Mind Clickers, where this is your host, Lachlan. It was really awesome having a chat with Conair, digging deep into really exposing some of those cognitive tests and the importance of them as well, especially within esports, as a lot of these players can benefit from them, especially when we start to look at pre-season compared to post-season and really starting to understand the values and, you know, that meaningful impact that they have. And as always, make sure to check out our sponsor, Player 2 Secondhand Gaming. Make sure you head over to www.player2oz.com and use code MIND10 for a whole 10% off your entire order. They've got something for every gamer.